Hi, I'm Kim Masters. Thanks for listening to The Business. Some of the most entertaining stories produced today aren't just on the big screen. They can be heard on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate tales and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the globe. Check it out. You can find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
So many things just happened. They fell in. It was almost like the penance I paid for 15 years of not being able to touch this as a project in Hollywood paid off in great dividends.
Author Michael Connelly sold the film rights to his famous detective character, Harry Bosch, years ago. But Bosch never made it to the big screen. Still, Connelly kept churning out the books, and now that he's finally gotten the rights back, he has plenty of material for the new Bosch series on Amazon. But first on the News Banter, the director gets jail time in the Midnight Rider case and intimations of mortality at Viacom. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am back from a break, rested and ready, and joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hey, Matt.
Hi there.
So the Midnight Rider case, and this is the infamous case in which a young Sarah Jones was killed when a train came onto a track. The production of this movie, Midnight Rider, this Greg Allman biopic, were attempting to steal a shot. The trial was about to begin, Matt, but I guess somewhat to people's surprise, the director pled guilty to a negligent homicide.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big surprise, is that there was no trial. We had the director, Randall Miller, pleading guilty. In exchange, his wife, Jody Savin, was essentially let off. The other producers that were on trial quickly pled as well. One got 10 years probation. The other got 5 years probation. Randall Miller, the director, really the only one who will serve jail time for this, about 2 years probably, and then he'll be on probation for 10 years. And the thing is, it is a historic thing that we're seeing here. It's the first time that an actual director is going to jail for something that occurred on the set of his movie. And that's the tragic death of this woman, Sarah Jones.
Yeah, it's the ultimate responsibility of the director or a first AD or that group of people. They are responsible for safety. And of course, you know, the minute this accident happened, a lot of people spoke out on the record, people who have experience in this kind of work, saying, what the heck were these people doing on those train tracks? And you knew that it was going to be, I thought, a tough row to hoe for Randall Miller, the director, who has a reputation and has talked about kind of guerrilla filmmaking and stealing shots, to say that there was nothing wrong when they had no permits to be there and clearly had not done the necessary preparation to shoot safely on what was a live railway track. So, you know, that brings, I guess, this to a close. And it's a pretty sad chapter. And of course, the hope is there'll be increased safety on the set after this.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that this case really has become a rallying cry for a lot of people in the below-the-line industry to make those calls and to make sure that things are safe on the set and to stand up when a director might be saying, you know what, let's see if we can steal that shot. I do think that you've seen that since this incident happened, and I think it'll only continue in the future.
I certainly hope so. Now, meanwhile, Viacom has been in the news. This is a time of year when there are shareholder meetings, and Sumner Redstone, the 91-year-old executive chairman of Viacom, who lives here in Los Angeles, is not going to appear at the company's annual shareholder meeting. Now, he's clearly been frail for some time, but usually they've managed one way or another. They've held the meeting in New York or L.A. They managed to get him there, however briefly. And it seems pretty clear, you know, and you hear here in Hollywood that Sumner Redstone is finally reaching a point, you know, where he is very elderly and who knows, sooner or later, Sumner Redstone will no longer be in the world. And the questions around what will happen to Viacom and CBS swirl.
Yeah, I think you're already seeing the first stages of that. Viacom is going through a restructuring right now that's eliminating a lot of jobs. And you hear a lot of people say that the reason that's happening is because it's sort of slimming down, because when Sumner goes, and that is probably sooner rather than later, there's either going to be a sale or an investment by someone or a split or a recombination of CBS and Viacom, which split years ago. Some kind of change is afoot, and the triggering factor will be when Sumner Redstone passes away.
Yeah, and there's been a little bit of a mystery. There is a committee that is going to sort of have the fate of the companies in its hands. But Philippe Domon, who is the head of Viacom, which is the parent of Paramount Pictures, Nickelodeon, MTV, all of these properties, he is the one who has really the power in this situation. He's a very, very close, he's super close to Sumner Redstone, knows, I think, where all the bodies are buried, and I may actually mean that literally. And he is the one who's going to be in charge. I don't think a lot of people see him as a potential seller.
Yeah, I think that's the big speculation as to whether they want to hold on to what is a very challenged business. I mean, Paramount Pictures recently gone through some executive changes. The Viacom networks are struggling in the ratings, and you're starting to see decreased ad revenue because of that. So I think that Viacom has a lot of changes that it needs to make. And the question is whether Philippe Domon or whoever is in charge is going to be willing to make those changes post-Redstone, or whether they're just going to sell.
And then there's CBS, run by Les Moonves, very successfully. A lot of people believe he'll want to buy CBS and lead a buyout of that company. Can he, will he be permitted to? You know, will there be a sale there? So that'll be a lot to watch. And finally, I'm going to just turn quickly to this Motion Picture Association. They annually release numbers about box office, and the trends continue to be not good. A big fall off in movie going among certain populations that are very important to theater owners and studios. And overall, a lot of people not going to the movies for reasons that we know very well. You know, it's expensive, and sometimes people don't like what's on offer. They don't like the environment, all of these reasons.
Yeah, the big stat that struck me in the report was 32% of Americans not going to any movies last year. That's a third of the population. You know, it used to be that going to the movies was a rite of passage in America. Now, for a third of the population, they don't go at all.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sharp decline in attendance, even among little kids, where, you know, the movie-going habit might get set. I mean, if it weren't for China, the things would be even, you know, much grimmer. But China is moving so quickly that, you know, it's up year over year. That box office grew 34%, and that's pretty big, and it's only getting bigger.
It's also influencing the kinds of movies that are being made. I mean, you're seeing the kinds of movies that are successful there. They're the big Hollywood blockbuster, Transformers, even Jupiter Ascending, which flopped in the U.S., did well there because it's a big 3D extravaganza. And you're seeing more of those movies set for 2015, 2016, 2017. The Star Wars movies, Avengers, those are movies that play here, but they especially play overseas in China and those developing markets.
On that note, I'll just briefly touch on Disney had its shareholder meeting. My goodness, what a victory lap for Bob Iger with all the properties they have. I'm just going to run through their list for 2017. Guardians of the Galaxy 2, Star Wars Episode 8, Toy Story 4, Pirates 5, Thor 3, and a Pixar movie. And you can complain about sequels and that kind of thing, but guess what? They make a lot of money. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. Detective Hieronymus Harry Bosch first started solving crimes for the LAPD Hollywood Division in the 1992 novel The Black Echo. 23 years and 17 novels later, author Michael Connelly is still dispatching Bosch to LA's darkest corners. In all that time, there's never been a Bosch movie. Two other Connelly novels, Bloodwork and The Lincoln Lawyer, were made into films, but Connelly didn't have much involvement with those projects. Now he's hands-on and on set every day with the new Amazon series, Bosch. The show draws on storylines from just three of the novels in the series. In this case, the busy detective is tracking down a serial killer while dealing with a lawsuit against him for killing a suspect in another case. In the pilot episode, attorney Honey Chandler, played by Mimi Rogers, attempts to make things personal for Bosch, played by Titus Welliver, as she tries to sweat him on the witness stand.
Your mother was a prostitute.
Yes.
Is your mother still living?
No.
How old were you when she died?
12.
How did she die?
She was murdered.
Was her murder ever solved?
No.
What happened to you after her murder?
I went into the system. Youth halls, foster homes.
So the killer was never caught, never punished?
No.
Detective, when you shot and killed Mr. Flores, weren't you, in effect, avenging your mother's death?
Objection.
You got a lot of f***ing nerve.
Connelly sat down with TV Guide's Michael Schneider, who's host of our podcast, The Spinoff, to talk about the joys of finally finding a home for Bosch on Amazon.
They said, we're only going to do this if you're involved. I mean, that was their philosophy. I mean, that makes common sense, it would seem, but it's not really the philosophy of Hollywood at large. Usually the book writer, they want your material, they want your story, but it's a different way of telling stories. And so they kind of say, we'll handle it from here. And that's happened to me with movies and so forth. But Amazon said, yeah, we're interested in this, but we want Michael to be there. We want him making choices here. So that was really refreshing, and I jumped at that chance. And I have to say, I was looking for that. I spent like 25 years of my life on this character, essentially, and I just didn't want to hand him off and say, good luck.
Were you also looking for sort of a new challenge, maybe a change in pace? I mean, I assume this sort of changed your life a little bit, and maybe you didn't have quite as much time over the past year to focus on your traditional novel writing.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm paying the price for that. I mean, I was all in on this TV show and put aside book writing, and now I'm back into writing the book as we wait to see if we get a second season. And, it is a different way of telling a story, and so I had to kind of refocus and to get back into the old groove. I feel like I'm in there now, but it took a while. So there is a price or a cost in doing this, jumping between these kinds of mediums, but I've been writing the books for a long time, and so it's been a great change. I've really enjoyed it.
What did you learn from this unique Amazon TV pilot process in that they upload the pilot before they actually decide which shows they're going to pick up? And that's part of the algorithm. There's a lot of different reasons that go into what they pick up and what they don't. But you get a chance before they actually order the series to kind of see viewer reaction, read the comments, find out what people are liking and what they're not liking so much.
I found it to be a great process. I think a lot of traditional writers and creators in Hollywood are a bit frightened by that. But to me, putting this out to the public where I have a pretty strong social media and I knew I could bring fans of the books and I was proud and confident in what we had done, I was like, oh, I'd rather do this all the time. And then the second part of that is you're right. We got feedback, and that feedback wasn't lost on us. When we got the order for a season, we paid attention to what people were saying, what they liked and didn't like about the pilot, and that did get folded into our thought process and, what we did when we wrote the next 9 episodes.
Was there anything in particular that you remember from that process that sort of maybe changed the tone of the show or the direction of where you guys went?
Yeah, there was a very significant change that I think paid off in a big way, and that was in the original pilot that we put out for public feedback or testing, whatever you want to call it. We had Harry starting a trial, and we started at the beginning, and so it became a lawyer show, and our protagonist is sitting there at a table not doing anything. And we realized through a lot of the feedback that Harry has to be active, and so when we got the go-ahead, we reconfigured that, and we come into the trial halfway through, and Harry's on the stand, and Harry's active participant in these scenes. And we use that as advice to bring out aspects of his background. And all that turned out to be, I think, the best way to go. And I think a lot of that came from listening to feedback.
So there was a plan for a Harry Bosch movie at one time. You sold the rights to Paramount in 1995, so about 20 years ago. What ultimately happened there?
Well, the short answer is nothing happened. But the real answer is people tried very hard at Paramount to get a movie, if not a series of movies, going. There are several scripts written. But ultimately, the climate in the 90s was that we're not making cop movies anymore because there's so many cop shows on television. So it ended up on the shelf, and it stayed on the shelf for more than 10 years until I could get it back.
I like in the series you actually name-check Paramount, and that's one of the reasons Harry Bosch lives in this amazing house overlooking in the Hollywood Hills on his LAPD salary. He's got this fantastic house because the rights were sold and a movie was made, and he pocketed some cash.
Yeah, we did have to have that explanation. In the books, he has a house that has a view of the city, but it's not quite as grand as what we ended up with in the TV show. And then we actually make this explanation twice specifically in the first season, and plus there's a poster from this supposed movie made by Paramount about Harry Bosch on display in his house at all times. So we're trying to explain it as much as possible.
Also, a little tiny, subtle dig at Paramount, like, hey, guys, this is what you could have had.
I think there's some of that going on in Hollywood where they were reluctant to give me back the books. And the bottom line is I actually had to sue Paramount to get the books back, and I got them back. And so, yeah, I mean, I have to say I didn't actually write those references to Paramount, but I didn't object to them.
Someone knew your story and thought you would approve of that. So how did you sort of end up doing TV and end up at Amazon?
Well, it was interesting. The world had changed. Two things happened. One is I kept writing about Harry Bosch, even though he was on the shelf, but kind of undaunted, I loved the character, so I kept writing about the character. And then I did get the books back back in 2011, and I had two things going for me. One, a lot of material, several books about Harry Bosch. And two, TV had changed, and we moved into this golden age of serialized television, especially when it came to crime. And I'm sitting there with, I think at that time, 13 or 14 books about Harry Bosch. Do I really want to dip my toe back into Hollywood and try to get a 2-hour movie? So right away, I mean, I have advisors and so forth, but pretty much my decision was right away when I got the books back. Let me look around at the TV environment and see if I can find someone interested in telling the serialized story of Harry Bosch.
I mean, this is a show that could have worked on broadcast. I could have seen it on any of the networks. I could have seen it on cable as well. It's interesting that you went to ultimately sort of what is the hot spot of the moment, streaming television, so Amazon.
I guess word had gone out that I had the property back and I was preparing to shop it around, and they made a preemptive strike and said, we want to take this off the table. And we didn't really hesitate. I certainly didn't, because this is also the place that sells more of my books than any other entity in the world. And I like that idea, that synchronicity. So right off the bat, I said, let's do this. So we were all for it. But, 3 years ago, it was a little bit of a different environment. There hadn't been House of Cards. There hadn't been Orange is the New Black. Amazon had one show they had just posted. So it was a little bit of a risk then. Now it seems like we were smart, but I don't know about that. I just think I wanted to do it because it was a bookstore.
On paper, that makes a lot of sense. Obviously, people who are going to buy your books can also then watch Bosch, the television series. Mm-hmm. But that also sort of ended up putting you in sort of an awkward, sticky situation over the past year when Hachette, which publishes your books, people may remember last year, was involved in a bitter public feud over pricing with Amazon. How awkward was that at the point where you were making the TV show, but your books were a little harder to purchase than they used to be on Amazon?
Yeah, I don't think awkward is a strong enough word. It was a very weird situation to be in, because I was going to work every day at an office where we were making this show for Amazon, for a company that at that point was not really selling my books. They were making, as you say, very difficult to get my books. And I think Amazon is somebody described it as a lot of silos that are somewhat interconnected. But, I mean, I felt the awkwardness was not just mine. It was shared by the Amazon people I was working with. And all we could do is hope that these corporate giants would work it out. And it got worked out 1 week after my last book came out. But luckily, a couple months before the show came out. So now everything's fine, but it was a trying time, I'd say.
Was there any ever pressure from Hachette to make a public statement? There were some other authors who did go out there and discuss this.
No, I mean, I didn't get pressure from either side. I got kind of reassurances from both sides that this kind of stuff is not that unusual. What was unusual is that it spilled over into the media. But no, I don't know. I kind of feel like when you're, quote unquote, the talent, people don't want to bring you bad news. So they kind of laid off me and didn't pressure me one way or the other about anything.
Coming up after a short break, author Michael Connelly explains why you might recognize several faces from HBO's immortal series, The Wire, in his show, Bosch. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
The This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're listening to my colleague, Michael Schneider, talk with Michael Connelly, the best-selling author of the Harry Bosch detective books. Connelly played a major part in the casting of Titus Welliver as Bosch, who's always on the job, even when he's on a date. In this case, with a rookie cop played by Annie Worshing.
I'm tired of patrol, Harry. I'm sick of it.
4 months in.
Feels like we're putting Band-Aids on bullet holes.
Everybody goes through that. Look, you want to be a detective, right?
So bad I can taste it.
There are no shortcuts. You gotta walk before you run.
You mean pay my dues?
Look, first couple of years are tough. You pick your battles, and it works out.
That's what I did today. I took some initiative. Like you've done your whole career.
Yeah, but the notorious insubordinate Harry Bosch.
Like Netflix, Amazon doesn't release ratings for its shows. Maybe Bosch could get to the bottom of it, but Connelly says he has no idea how many people are watching the show.
Yeah, I don't know which is worse, to be under the shoe of the ratings or to be in the dark. I mean, from the very beginning, there was a caveat. Amazon said, we want to take this off the table, but we're not going to ever tell you what the numbers are because we don't have to and we don't want to reveal numbers. And, you know, at the time, it was like, okay, that's cool. And now we're in a situation where we've really worked hard for 2 years on a very creative thing. And Amazon says they're ecstatic. They're over their moon. They say all these superlatives, but we don't know what that means. Like, what does very happy translate to? Millions of viewers, tens of millions, 100,000, you know, and that is something that we're still trying to parse. Ultimately, if they say we want another season, which we hope to get that word very soon, then there is a measure there. But it's a strange world in that, you know, and it's the same with Netflix. You never know exactly how many people are watching.
Right, and you never know up until they finally give you that second season whether or not you're on track or anything. I mean, do they even sort of give you a hint and you're in the right direction, you're heading in the right direction, or do you really just not know up until they give you the call and say, we want season two?
Well, we've had conversations where they say, what will season two be? What are the books or book that you want to try to take the story to the next step, what it would be. So there's all kinds of that kind of discussion, and that's why I think they're happy with what's going on in terms of viewership. They are happy in what we produced. We were good partners, like we weren't over budget, anything like that. So I think all signs are pointing towards a pretty quick pickup.
Well, let's talk about the casting real quick, because Titus Welliver obviously, you know, kind of personifies Bosch. But, you know, famously, you haven't really, never really had an idea of what Bosch was going to look like. And did that give you an opportunity to sort of cast a wide net on who you wanted? How did you guys sort of settle on Titus?
Yeah, I think in the 17 or 18 books, now I'm losing count, I don't describe Bosch very much at all. Just a few things here and there. And the things that I have used as descriptors in the books don't even match Titus. I think Harry has I know Harry has a mustache. I know he has very dark eyes, very hard to read eyes because they're so dark and piercing. And Titus doesn't have a mustache. He has pale eyes. But, you know, he's an internal character in the books. Harry's got a tortured past. He's got a lot of internal demons. You know, we need someone who can bring it, who can show that in his looks and in his eyes. And so it doesn't matter whether he has dark, piercing eyes or pale blue eyes. It's what's behind those eyes. And I had DVR'd the pilot of a show called Touch and never seen it. And I think the show was already canceled, but I just wanted to see it because I was a big fan of 24, and this was Kiefer Sutherland's next show. And so I watched it. And Titus was the guest star, and he played a veteran who had post-traumatic stress syndrome. And there was just something about what was behind his eyes that I connected with. I said, that's what Harry Bosch has. And so, again, I'm the novice in TV, and I go into the first casting meeting, and I look at the names, and I don't see Titus Welliver. And I'm thinking, like, what if I bring him up? Will I be shouted down? Will I be saying, are you kidding, or whatever? And I said, what does everyone here think about this guy, Titus Welver? And they go, oh, we love Titus Welver, but he's in Hong Kong. So I was kind of redeemed right away. And then it was lucky that, you know, we were able to get him back just to come in and talk to us.
That's also a nice reminder that, you know, as the writer coming in, that your opinion is taken seriously. And maybe that wouldn't be the same case in the film world as it is in TV.
I totally agree. I don't think it would be. It is an amazing story that a guy whose name I timidly threw out ends up being Harry Bosch, because long before we got to that room, you know, the showrunner is Eric Overmeyer, who is someone I knew before this project, and we sat together in New York back when he signed up. He's already familiar with the books, and he said, we got two great challenges. One is how to get this very internalized character out. And then the second biggest challenge is finding the actor who can do that. I feel great that I had a part in that.
Well, let's talk about Eric real quick, because, you know, fans of The Wire will recognize some familiar faces on the show as well. Jamie Hector and Lance mm-hmm. Reddick. Was that the Eric Overmeyer connection? And, you know, his experience on The Wire, what does that add also to Bosch?
Well, the aura of accuracy in The Wire is usually impressionable, and why that show gets so many accolades. And so that was my fervent hope, that if we were able to get a show going on Harry Bosch, that we would bring that same kind of accuracy. You know, my partner on this, another executive producer, Henrik Bastin, he's the guy who came to me and said, let's do this. So then we have to find a showrunner. Before we can even talk about who's Harry Bosch, we need someone who's going to run the show. And I said, well, I know one guy, one showrunner who's done some great work and is familiar with the books. I mean, because that was one of the things. Wherever we can, we want to bring in someone who knows the books. And so we set up a meeting with Eric in New York. That meeting only lasted about 15 minutes because, well, we all agreed. Like he said, I'm in. If you guys are in, I'm in. And so we all were in. And then later, your thing about the connections were, yeah, definitely. We used his connections. He got right to Lance. He got right to Jamie. Some of our directors worked on The Wire and his other shows. And so when you think of a showrunner, you think of like a head writer and a guy doing all that stuff. But Eric's involvement in other aspects was huge and very important.
It sounds pretty gratifying that after you struggled for 15 years to make Bosch into an actual film reality, and it sounds like on the TV side, things kind of serendipitously fell into place in getting Titus Welliver, in getting Eric, and kind of just this whole Amazon experience has been, you know, all TV is hard, but this sounds like it kind of worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, serendipity is the right word. So many things just happened. They fell in. It was almost like the penance I paid for 15 years of not being able to touch this as a project in Hollywood kind of paid off in great dividends that it worked out. You know, I think about little steps along the way, that meeting with Eric where he kind of cut us off. We were kind of pitching him. And he goes like, am I trying out for you or are you trying out for me? Because I'm in if you're in. And then we said, okay, we're all in. What do we do next? And that kind of stuff was amazing. Like Eric wasn't even with us because we heard from Joe Lewis at Amazon, who said, hey, I heard about this project from a guy on the book side of Amazon who I've known for years in publishing. He had mentioned this to Joe Lewis. He said, let's have a lunch and talk about what you're doing. So Henrik and I went thinking we were just going to have a get-to-know-you lunch. And 10 minutes into that lunch, he said, we want to take this off the table. And it was like, what? And it was like, so we suddenly, and you're talking to a guy who works in a room by himself. Pitching in Hollywood is like antithetical to everything I know. I can't stand it. I can't even stand to think about it. And so we were gearing up to take this around town and pitch it. And Eric is also an introverted guy just like me. We don't like the pitch. And so to have someone say we're taking it off the table was like, oh my gosh, talk about serendipity. This is fantastic.
Well, Michael Connelly's show Bosch is available now on Amazon. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business. Stay tuned. The world is coming up next.